Moralia, de defectuor culorum. Some say, Terentius Priscus, that two eagles, or as others tell it, two swans, flying from the outer limits of the earth toward the center, met each other at Pytho, at the place called the navel of the earth, and that later Epimenides of Phaestus, testing the myth before the god and receiving an obscure and ambiguous oracle, reported it thus. For there was no navel of the earth, nor of the sea. And if there is one, it is manifest to the gods but invisible to mortals. The god then fittingly punished that man for trying to test, by touch, as it were, an old myth like a painted image. Shortly before the Pythian games held under Callistratus, two holy men happened to come together at Delphi from opposite ends of the inhabited world. Demetrius the Grammarian, on his way home from Britain to Tarsus, and Cleombrotus of Lacedaemon, who had wandered widely in Egypt and around the Troglodyte country, and had sailed far up the Red Sea, not for trade, but as a man fond of seeing and learning things. He had a sufficient fortune, and did not think it worth much to have more than sufficient, so he devoted his leisure to such pursuits, and was gathering material for a work he called Theology, as though it were the raw material of philosophy brought to its completion. Having recently been to the shrine of Ammon, he showed that he was not greatly impressed by most things there, but he related, as worthy of serious attention, an account told by the priests concerning the inextinguishable lamp, that it consumed less oil each year, and that the priests took this as proof of an irregularity in the length of years, each successive year being shorter in time than the one before, for it stood to reason that in a shorter time the amount consumed would be less. Those present were amazed, and Demetrius said it was ridiculous to hunt after such great conclusions from such small facts, not, in Alcaeus's phrase, judging the lion from its claw, but from a wick and a lamp overturning virtually the whole heavens and utterly destroying the science of mathematics. Cleombrotus replied, "None of this will trouble the men in question. They will not yield in precision to the mathematicians. Indeed, it is more likely that time would elude the mathematicians in movements and cycles so vastly extended than that these priests, who continually attend to the measure of the oil because of the strangeness of the phenomenon, would be deceived by paying such close attention to it. To deny, Demetrius, that small signs can indicate great things is an obstacle to many arts. For this would mean depriving many proofs and many predictions of their validity. And yet you yourselves demonstrate no small thing when, having come across Homer naming a razor, you conclude that heroes shaved their bodies with a razor, or that they lent money at interest, because he says somewhere that a debt was owed, not new nor small, taking owed to indicate increased. Again, when he calls the knight swift, you eagerly seize upon the word and claim this very thing shows that he understood the earth's shadow to be conical, being cast by a spherical body. As for medicine, does it not foretell a plague-ridden summer by an abundance of spiders' webs, and by fig leaves in spring when they become like a crow's foot? Who among those who insist that small signs cannot indicate great things will allow this? And who will tolerate the sun's magnitude being measured against a jug and a pint of water, or that the little wedge here, which forms an acute angle inclined to the plane, is said to be the measure of the elevation? That is, how far the ever-visible pole is raised above the horizon. For these were the things one could hear from the prophets there. So we should say something different to them, if we wish to keep the customary order fixed for the sun according to ancestral tradition. At this point Ammonius the philosopher, who was present, exclaimed, "One should say this not only of the sun, but of the whole heaven. For its passage from solstice to solstice must necessarily contract, and not remain as great a portion of the horizon as the mathematicians say, but grow smaller, since the northern points are always drawing closer together with the southern. And our summer becomes shorter, and the climate colder, as the sun bends inward and touches larger parallel circles at the tropical points. Moreover, the sundials at sea no longer appear shadowless around the summer solstice, and many of the fixed stars have sunk below the horizon, while some now touch and merge with one another, the space between them having disappeared. And if, on the other hand, they should claim that, all else being equal, the sun alone is irregular in its movements, they will not be able to state a single cause for its acceleration out of so many phenomena, and they will throw the majority of observed facts into confusion, and this holds especially with respect to the moon, so that there is no need for measures of oil to establish the discrepancy. For the eclipses will prove it, both when the sun encroaches on the moon more often, and when the moon encroaches on the earth's shadow, the rest is clear, and there is no need to unwind further the pretentiousness of this argument. But indeed, said Cleombrotus, I myself saw the measurement. For they showed many instances, and the yearly measure fell short of the oldest ones by no small amount. Ammonius took this up again and said, Then has it escaped the notice of other people, among whom undying fires are tended and preserved for a span of years that is, so to speak, unlimited. But even if one were to suppose that what is said is true, is it not better to attribute the cause to certain coldnesses and dampnesses of the air, under whose influence the fire, being weakened, presumably cannot master much fuel nor need much nourishment, or, conversely, to dryness and heat? For I have already heard some people say, concerning fire, that in winter it burns better, being drawn together and condensed by the cold through its own strength. But in droughts it grows weak and becomes loose and slack, and even if it burns in sunlight it works worse, taking hold of its fuel feebly and consuming it more slowly. And one might especially trace the cause back to the oil itself. For it is not unreasonable that it was once unnourishing and watery, being produced from a young plant, but later, as it ripened in mature trees and was composed from an equal quantity, it became stronger and more nourishing. This is a better explanation, if we must salvage the story told by the priests of Ammon, even though the hypothesis is strange and out of the ordinary. When Ammonius had finished, I said, Rather, Cleombrotus, tell us about the oracle, for great was the ancient reputation of the divinity there, but now it seems to be fading. Cleombrotus fell silent and looked down, and Demetrius said, There is no need to inquire about matters there and puzzle over the dimming of the oracles here, when we see the eclipse of virtually all of them except one or two. Rather, we should consider the reason why they have grown so weak. For why should I mention the rest, when Boeotia, which in former times was rich in oracular voices because of its shrines, has now utterly failed, like dried-up streams, and a great drought of divination has overtaken the land. Nowhere else now, except around Lebedea, does Boeotia offer those in need a source of prophecy to draw upon. Of the rest, some have fallen into silence, others into complete desolation. And yet, at the time of the Persian Wars, it was no less renowned than the Oracle of Amphiaraus, and Mise, it seems, tested both. The prophet of the Oracle of Tus, using the Aeolic tongue, delivered the oracle in the language of the barbarians, before he had ever done so previously, so that none of the sacred officials present understood him, showing that it is not possible, nor granted, for the barbarians to receive any share of divine inspiration by taking on a Greek voice to serve what is commanded. And the slave sent to the oracle of Amphiaraus dreamed that a servant of the god appeared to him, and first tried to drive him away by voice, since the god would not admit him, then pushed him back with his hands. And when he persisted, the servant took up a large stone and struck him on the head. This was, as it were, an answering sign of what was to come, for Mardonius was defeated, he who led the Greeks not as king but as steward and servant of the king, and he fell, struck by a stone, just as the Lydian dreamed he had been struck. At that time, the oracle at Tegira was also at its height, where they say the god himself was born, and where two streams flow nearby, one called Phoenix and the other Alia, as some still say to this day. In the Persian Wars, when Echecrates was prophesying, the god foretold victory and mastery in war for the Greeks. And in the Peloponnesian War, they say, when the Delians were driven from their island, an oracle came from Delphi instructing them to find the place where Apollo was born and to perform certain sacrifices there. When they wondered and were at a loss, since they did not think the god had been born among them but elsewhere, the Pythia gave a further response, that a crow would show them the place. So as they were leaving, they came to Chaeronea, and there they heard the innkeeper speaking to some strangers on their way to Tegira about the oracle. And when the strangers, as they were departing, greeted and addressed the woman by her name, which happened to be Chaeron, meaning crow, they understood the oracle, and after sacrificing at Tegira, they obtained the return home they sought within a short time. There have been more recent manifestations at these oracles as well, but now they have failed, so that it is worth inquiring of Apollo the Pythian himself the cause of the change. By now, as we were walking from the temple, we had come to the doors of the clubhouse of the Cnidians. Going inside, we saw the friends to whom we were going seated and waiting for us. The rest of the place was quiet because of the hour, people being anointed or watching the athletes. Demetrius, smiling, said, "Shall I speak falsehood or the truth? You seem to me to have no worthy problem in hand, for I see you sitting very much at ease, your faces relaxed." Heraclian of Megara took this up and said, "We are not investigating whether the verb ballo loses its lambda in the future tense, nor from what simple words the comparative, the worse, the better, the worst, and the best are formed. These questions and others like them perhaps do knit the brow and set the face. But as for the rest, one may keep one's eyebrows in their proper place and still philosophize and inquire, without looking fierce or being harsh toward those present." "Then receive us," said Demetrius, "and our discussion along with us, one that has fallen to us as fitting for this place, and, because of the god, a concern belonging to everyone. See that you do not knit your brows in the attempt." So we mingled together and sat down among them, and Demetrius put the topic forward for discussion. At once Didymus, the cynic, surnamed Planisheades, leapt up, and striking the ground two or three times with his staff, cried out, "Alas, alas, what a hard matter to judge, and requiring much inquiry you have brought us. For it is a marvel, if with so much wickedness poured out upon it, not only, as Hesiod foretold, have shame and retribution abandoned human life, but even the providence of the gods has packed up and departed from the oracles everywhere. On the contrary, I put forward for you to consider this problem instead. Why is it that Heracles, or some other god, has not by now snatched away the tripod, filled as it is with shameful and godless questions, which people put to the god, some testing him as though he were a sophist, others inquiring about treasures, inheritances, or unlawful marriages, so that Pythagoras stands utterly refuted for saying that men become their best selves when they approach the gods? For in this way, what would properly be denied and hidden as diseases and afflictions of the soul in the presence of an older man, these things people bring naked and exposed before the god." While he still wished to speak, Heraclian took hold of his cloak, and I, being about as close a friend to him as anyone, said, "Stop, dear Planisheades, provoking the god, for he is even-tempered and gentle, and has been judged by mortals to be the most gracious of all, as Pindar says. And whether he is the sun, or lord of the sun and father of it and beyond all that is visible, it is not likely that he would deem the men of today unworthy of his voice, he who is the cause of their birth, nourishment, existence, and thought, nor that providence, like a kind and good mother who does everything for us and watches over us, would alone bear a grudge in the matter of divination, and take this away after having given it from the beginning, as if there were not, back then too. When oracles were established in many places throughout the inhabited world, just as many, or more wicked men among a greater number of people. Come now, sit back down, and having made a Pythian truce with the vice which you are always accustomed to chastise in your speeches, seek along with us some other cause for this so-called eclipse of the oracles, and keep the god gracious and free from wrath." By saying this, I accomplished only this much, that Planisheades left through the doors in silence. When there had been quiet for a little while, Ammonius addressed me and said, "See what we are doing, Lamprias, and pay close attention to the argument, so that we do not make the god blameless of nothing. For whoever supposes that the cessation of oracles has come about through some other cause, and not by the will of the god, gives grounds for suspecting that they neither come to be nor exist because of the god at all, but are thought to occur in some other way. For there is no other power greater or stronger, such that it could destroy and abolish divination, which is the work of a god." Now Planisheades' argument does not please me, both for other reasons and for the inconsistency it creates concerning the god, turning away from and disdaining wickedness on the one hand, but on the other admitting it again, like some king or tyrant who bars the wicked at one door, but receives and does business with them through another. But as for the argument that a work fitting for gods above all should be moderate, sufficient, in no way excessive, but in every way self-sufficient, if one were to begin from this premise, saying that of the general scarcity of population, which the earlier factional strife and wars produced throughout virtually the whole inhabited world, Greece has had the greatest share, and could now scarcely furnish 3,000 hoplites in total. As many as the single city of Megara once sent out to Plataea, so that it was nothing other than exposing the desolation of Greece for the god to have left so many oracles standing. I would grant him precisely this piece of ingenious argument. For what good would it do if there were still an oracle at Tegira as there once was, or at Tuz, where nowadays in broad daylight one might encounter a man pasturing his flock? For indeed this too, which is the oldest oracle there, in time. In time and famous in reputation, was for a long time deserted and unapproachable because of a fierce beast, a serpent, so the story goes. But people who say this get the causation backwards. It was not the desertion of the place that produced the beast, rather it was the desolation that drew the beast there, more than the beast that caused the desolation. But once the god had resolved that Greece should be strengthened with cities and this region grow populous with people, they used two prophetesses serving in rotation, with a third also appointed as reserve. Now, however, there is a single prophetess, and we do not blame the god for it, since she alone suffices for those who need her. So the god should not be blamed either. The prophetic power that exists and continues in operation is adequate for everyone, and sends away all who come to it having gotten what they need. Just as Agamemnon employed 9 heralds and could scarcely control the assembly because of its size, whereas within a few days you will see in the theater a single voice reaching everyone, so too, in those days, the prophetic art used more voices for a greater number of people. Whereas now, on the contrary, one would have had to be surprised at the god if he had allowed prophecy to go to waste, uselessly flowing away like water, or, like the rocks echoing back the voices of shepherds and flocks in a wilderness. When Ammonius had said this and I remained silent, Cleombrotus turned to me and said, "Have you now granted this, that these oracles both come into being and also perish, and that the god is thereby done away with?" "Not I," I said. "For I do not say that any oracle or shrine perishes by the agency of the god. But just as he, while doing and providing many other things for us, allows nature, or rather matter, since it is a privation, often to escape and to dissolve what has come into being under the influence of the better cause, so too, I think, there are other eclipses and destructions of prophetic powers, since the god gives men many good things but nothing immortal. So that even the things of the gods die, though the gods themselves do not, as Sophocles says. Their essence and power, they say, must be sought in nature and in matter, since it is proper that the gods' rule be preserved. For it is silly and altogether childish to suppose that the god himself, like the ventriloquists once called uracles and now called pythons, enters into the bodies of the prophets and speaks through them, using their mouths and voices as instruments. Whoever mixes the god into human needs in this way does not spare his dignity, nor does he preserve for him the majesty and greatness of his excellence. And Cleombrotus said, "You are right, but it is difficult to grasp and define how far, and up to what point, providence should be used, some making the god responsible for nothing at all, others making him virtually the cause of everything, and both miss the mean and the fitting." Those are right, then, who say that, Plato, by discovering the substrate element underlying qualities as they come into being, what people now call matter and nature, freed philosophers from many great difficulties. But it seems to me that those who established the race of demons midway between gods and men, and discovered a kind of bond that draws our community together and connects it, resolved more numerous and greater difficulties still. Whether this doctrine belongs to the Magi around Zoroaster, or is Thracian and derives from Orpheus, or Egyptian, or Phrygian. As we may conjecture from observing how much that is mortal and mournful is mixed into the rites, and sacred acts performed in the initiations on both sides. Among the Greeks, Homer still appears to use both names indifferently, sometimes calling the gods demons as well. But Hesiod was the first to set out clearly and distinctly 4 kinds of rational beings: gods, then demons, then heroes, and last of all, men, from which he seems to derive the transformation, with the golden race being separated off into many good demons, and the race of demigods into heroes. Others hold that transformation occurs likewise in bodies and in souls. For just as water is seen to be generated from earth, air from water, and fire from air, as their substance is carried upward, so from men the better souls make their transformation into heroes, and from heroes into demons. and from demons a few, over a long time, purified through virtue, come to share fully in divinity. But with some it happens that they do not master themselves, but, giving way and putting on mortal bodies again, they hold a dim and faint life, like a kind of exhalation. Hesiod, moreover, thinks that the deaths of demons occur after certain cycles of time, for he speaks in the person of the naiad, hinting also at the length of time. 9 generations of men in their prime does the cawing crow live. The stag lives 4 crows' lives. The raven grows old through 3 stags' lives, while the phoenix lives 9 ravens' lives. And we, the fair-tressed nymphs, daughters of Zeus who bears the aegis, live 10 phoenixes' lives. Those who do not understand the generation correctly draw this span of time out to a great multitude of number. For the number works out so that the whole life of the demons comes to 9,720 years. This is less than most of the mathematicians reckon, though Pindar states no more, when he says that the nymphs live to a span, reaching the term of an age equal to a tree's, which is also why they call themselves Hamadryads. While he was still speaking, Demetrius broke in and said, "How do you mean, Cleombrotus, that a generation of a man is said to be a year? For the length of a human life is not what is meant by either in their prime or growing old, as some read it. But those who read in their prime make the generation 30 years, following Heraclitus, the time in which the one who has begotten furnishes one begotten from himself capable of begetting in turn. Others, however, who write growing old rather than in their prime, assign 108 years to the generation. For they say 54 years is the boundary of the midpoint of human life, being composed of the starting unit and the first 2 plane numbers, 2 square numbers, and 2 cube numbers, which Plato also took as numbers in his account of the generation of the soul. And the whole account seems to have been put by Hesiod as a riddle pointing toward the conflagration, at the time when it is likely that the nymphs, who inhabit the beautiful groves and the springs of rivers and the grassy meadows, will perish together with the moisture." And Cleombrotus said, "I have heard this from many, and I see the Stoic conflagration creeping, as it were, over the verses of Heraclitus and Orpheus, and likewise taking hold of Hesiod's as well, and setting them ablaze too. But I cannot accept the destruction of the cosmos being spoken of, nor the impossibilities and the things one is reminded of by those words, especially the ones about the crow and the stag being applied to such excessive lengths. A year does not in itself encompass both a beginning and an end together of all that the seasons bring and earth brings forth, nor is a generation of men named without reason. And you yourselves surely agree that Hesiod means by generation a human lifetime, do you not?" Demetrius agreed. "But this too is clear," said Cleombrotus, "that often the measure and the things measured are called by the same names, a cotyle, a choinix, an amphora, a metemnis. Just as then we call the unit, being the smallest measure of the whole number series, both a measure and the beginning number, so too he named the year, by which we first measure a man's life, generation, using the same name as the thing measured. And indeed, the numbers those others construct have none of the notable and brilliant properties recognized in mathematics as such. Whereas the number 9,720 arises by composition from 4 fours taken successively from the unit and multiplied by 4, for it comes to 40 either way. And these, multiplied 5 times as a triangular number, yield the number in question. But there is no need for us to quarrel with Demetrius over these matters. For whether the time in which a demon's soul or a hero's life passes into a change be longer or shorter, ordered or disordered, nonetheless it will be shown, on the point he wishes to make, with the support of wise and ancient witnesses, that there are certain natures, as it were in the borderland between gods and men, admitting of mortal experiences and necessary changes, beings whom it is right, following our father's custom, to consider and address as demons and to revere. As an illustration for this account, Xenocrates, Plato's companion, used the case of triangles, likening the equilateral to the divine, the scalene to the mortal, and the isosceles to the demonic. For the equal-sided is equal in every way, the scalene unequal in every way, while the isosceles is equal in one respect and unequal in another. Just as the nature of demons possesses both the passibility of the mortal and the power of the god. Nature has set forth perceptible images and visible likenesses of this, of the gods, the sun, and the stars, of mortals, meteors, and comets and shooting flashes, as Euripides likened them when he said, "And he, but now in the flush of flesh, like a fallen star, was quenched, breathing out his spirit into the upper air." And truly the moon is a mixed body and a genuine likeness of the demonic kind, in that it harmonizes with the revolution proper to that class, undergoing visible wanings and waxings and changes, so that some have called it an earthy star, others an Olympian earth, and others still have assigned it as the portion of Hecate, both thonic and celestial together. Just as, if one were to remove the air and draw away what lies between earth and moon, one would, by creating an empty and disconnected region in the middle, dissolve the unity and community of the whole. So too those who do not leave room for the race of demons make the affairs of gods and men unmixed and incommunicable with one another, doing away with the interpretive and ministering nature, as Plato called it. Or else they force us to confound and disturb everything together by bringing the god down into human passions and affairs and dragging him into our needs, just as the Thessalian women are said to drag down the moon. Now that reputation for wickedness among women found credence in the case of Aglaonis, daughter of Hegeter, an astronomer, as they say, who, at every eclipse of the moon, always pretended to be bewitching it and drawing it down. As for us, let us neither hear it said that any forms of divination are wholly without divine inspiration, or that rites and orgiastic ceremonies are neglected by the gods, nor, on the other hand, let us suppose that the god himself busies himself among these things, being present and personally managing them, but assigning them, as is just, to ministers of the gods, as it were, servants and secretaries. Let us hold that demons are overseers of sacred rites and celebrants of divine mysteries, while others go about as avengers of arrogant and great acts of injustice. Those whom Hesiod, in a very solemn way, calls holy and givers of wealth, and says they hold this privilege that belongs to kings, since to do good is a kingly thing. For just as among men, so also among demons there are differences of virtue, and of the passionate and irrational element. In some, it remains a weak and dim residue, like a leftover, while in others it is present in great and hardly quenchable measure, traces and tokens of which are preserved and kept scattered about in many places by sacrifices and rites and mythologies. Concerning the mystic rites, then, in which one can obtain the greatest illuminations and glimpses of the truth about demons, let my lips be sealed, as Herodotus says. But as for festivals and sacrifices, like ill-omened and gloomy days, in which there are eatings of raw flesh and tearings apart, fastings and beatings of breasts, and in many places again shameful language spoken near the sacred rites, and frenzies and shrieks with tossing of the neck in wild confusion, these, I would say, are performed not for the sake of any of the gods, but as propitiations and appeasements meant to turn away evil demons. And it is not plausible that the human sacrifices once performed were demanded or accepted by the gods, nor would kings and generals have submitted to them in vain, giving up and consecrating and slaying their own children, unless they were thereby averting the wrath and heavy displeasure of harsh and intractable beings, avenging spirits, and, in some cases, appeasing frenzied and tyrannical lusts on the part of beings who were neither able nor willing to have intercourse with bodies, or through bodies. But just as Heracles besieged Oechalia for the sake of a girl, so strong and violent demons, demanding in return a human soul still bound up in a body, bring plagues upon cities and barrenness upon the land, and stir up wars and civil strife, until they obtain and gain what they desire. Some, on the other hand, have had the opposite experience, as I learned during a long stay in Crete, where I came to know of a strange festival being celebrated, in which they display a headless image of a man and say that this was Molus, the father of Myrians, who, having forced himself upon a nymph, was found to be headless. And indeed, as for all the things told and sung of in myths and hymns, abductions, wanderings, concealments, and flights and periods of servitude on the part of gods, these are not sufferings and misfortunes of gods, remembered because of their virtue and power, but of demons, and neither what Aeschylus said of Apollo, pure god, exiled from heaven, nor what Sophocles Admetus says, my own cock led him to the mill, are true of a god. those who go most astray from the truth are the theologians of Delphi, who believe that here, once, there occurred a battle between the god and a serpent over the oracle, and who allow poets and prose writers, competing in theaters, to say these things, as though deliberately bearing false witness against the very rites they themselves perform, the most sacred of all. When Philip expressed astonishment at this, for the writer was present, and asked what divine matters he thought the competitors were bearing false witness against, he said, "Against these here, concerning the oracle, matters with which the city, having just now consecrated all the Greeks outside the gates in her sacred rites, has driven her procession as far as Tempe. For the hut that is set up here beside the thrashing floor every 9 years is not a den or lair belonging to the serpent, but a representation of a tyrant's or king's dwelling. And the approach made upon it in silence, by way of what is called the Delonia, in which they lead the boy who still has both parents living, not idly, with torches lit, and after setting fire to the hut and overturning the table, flee without looking back through the doors of the sanctuary. And finally, the boy's wanderings and servitude, and the purifications that take place around Tempe, give rise to a suspicion of some great pollution and daring deed. For it is altogether ridiculous, my friend, that Apollo, after killing the beast, should flee to the ends of Greece in need of purification, and there pour libations of some sort, and do the things that men do when they are propitiating and appeasing the resentment of demons, whom they call avenging and blood-guilty spirits, as if visiting upon someone the memory of certain unforgettable and ancient pollutions. As for the account I have heard concerning this flight and this removal, it is exceedingly strange and paradoxical. But if it has any share of truth in it, let us not suppose that what was done at the oracle in those times was a small or ordinary matter. But so that I not seem to be doing what Empedocles did, attaching one set of summits to another and telling no single connected tale, allow me to put upon my earlier remarks the conclusion that befits them, since we have now arrived at it. Let it be ventured, after so many others, that we too may say that when the spirits appointed over oracles and divinations fail entirely, such powers fail along with them, and when the spirits have fled or removed elsewhere, they lose their force. Then, when those same spirits are present again after a long interval, the oracles speak once more, like instruments, when those who use them stand by and are present. When Cleombrotus had gone through all this, Heraclian said, "None of the uninitiated and profane, and none holding beliefs about the gods that clash with ours, is present here. But let us ourselves be on our guard, Philip, lest without noticing it, we grant our argument premises that are strange and extravagant." "Well said," replied Philip, "but what exactly is it in Cleombrotus's claims that troubles you most?" And Heraclian said, "That gods themselves, beings for whom it is fitting to be free from earthly concerns, should be set in charge of the oracles, rather than spirits who are servants of the gods, does not seem to me an unreasonable claim. But to take, virtually by the handful, from the verses of Empedocles the sins and follies and god-driven wanderings that he ascribes to spirits, and in the end to suppose that they even die as men do, I regard as rather too bold and altogether too barbarous a notion." Cleombrotus then asked Philip who this young man was and where he came from, and on learning his name and city, he said, "We ourselves have not gone unnoticed either, Heraclian, in holding strange views. But it is not possible, in dealing with great matters, to advance to a plausible opinion without employing great starting points. You, however, without realizing it, are taking back with one hand what you grant with the other. You agree that spirits exist, but by refusing to allow that they can be base or mortal, you no longer keep them as spirits at all. For in what do they then differ from the gods, if they possess indestructibility in their being and freedom from passion and from wrongdoing in their character?" To this Heraclian made no reply, being lost in some thought of his own, and Cleombrotus went on. But it was not Empedocles alone, Heraclian, who allowed for base spirits. Plato did too, and Xenocrates and Chrysippus, and Democritus as well, in praying to meet with well-omened images, plainly recognized that there exist other images, ill-tempered and vicious, possessing certain purposes and impulses of their own. As for the death of such beings, I have heard an account from a man neither foolish nor a charlatan. Emelianus the orator, whose father Epitherses, some of you have also heard, my own fellow citizen and a teacher of grammar, used to tell how once, sailing to Italy, he boarded a ship carrying merchandise and a good many passengers. Toward evening, near the Echinades Islands, the wind died down, and the ship, drifting, came close to Paxi. Most of the passengers were awake, and many were still drinking after their meal, when suddenly a voice was heard from the island of Paxi, someone calling loudly for Thamus, so that they were astonished. This Thamus was an Egyptian pilot, not even known by name to many on board. Twice he was called and kept silent, but the third time he answered the one calling. And that voice, raising itself still louder, said, "When you come opposite Palodes, announce that the great Pan is dead." On hearing this, Epitherses said, all were astounded, and debated among themselves whether it would be better to carry out the order or rather not to meddle but let it be. And Thamus resolved that if there were wind he would sail past in silence, but if there were a calm and stillness about the place he would proclaim what he had heard. So when they came opposite Palodes, with neither wind nor wave, Thamus, looking from the stern toward the land, said, just as he had heard it, that the great Pan is dead. He had scarcely finished speaking when a great cry went up, not of one voice, but of many, mingled with astonishment. And since many people were present, the story quickly spread throughout Rome, and Thamus was sent for by Tiberius Caesar. Tiberius came to believe the account so firmly that he made inquiry and investigation about Pan. And the scholars around him, of whom there were many, conjectured that this was the Pan born of Hermes and Penelope. Philip then had this account, and could also call as witnesses some of those present who had heard it from the aged Emilianus himself. Demetrius said that among the islands lying off Britain there are many lying scattered and deserted, some of which are named after spirits and heroes, and that he himself, sailing for the sake of inquiry and observation, at the king's bidding, to the nearest of the deserted islands, found it having not many inhabitants, but these all held sacred and inviolable by the Britons. Soon after his arrival, there occurred a great disturbance in the atmosphere, with many portents from the sky, winds bursting forth, and thunderbolts falling. And when this had subsided, the islanders said that some one of the mightier beings had passed away. For just as a lamp, he said, causes no distress while it is burning, but its going out is grievous to many, so the great souls in their kindlings bring benefit and cause no pain, but their extinguishings and destructions often, as now, breed storms and squalls and often infect the air with pestilential afflictions. There, moreover, he said, there is one island in which Cronus is confined, kept guarded in sleep by Briareus. For sleep has been contrived as a bond for him, and around him are many spirits as his attendants and servants. Taking this up, Cleombrotus said, I too could tell such tales, but it suffices for our present purpose that there is nothing to contradict or prevent things being so. And yet we know that the Stoics hold not only the view I have expressed about spirits, but also that, of the many gods there are, they make use of one that is eternal and indestructible, while regarding all the others as having come into being and being destined to perish. As for the mockery and laughter of the Epicureans, we need not fear it at all, since they dare to use it even against Providence itself, calling it a mere myth. We, for our part, say that it is a myth to suppose that, among so many worlds, not one is governed by a divine reasoning power, but that all have come to be and hold together purely by chance. And if one must laugh in philosophy, it is rather the mute, blind, and soulless images that deserve laughter, the ones that certain people heard through boundless cycles of years, appearing and wandering everywhere, some given off from the still living, others long since burnt or rotted away, dragging in idle chatter and shadows to explain natural phenomena. And yet if someone says that spirits exist, not merely by nature but by reason too, and that they preserve and endure for a long time, these same people grow indignant. When this had been said, Ammonius remarked, Theophrastus seems to me to have declared the matter rightly. For what prevents us from accepting a solemn and most philosophical account? Indeed, a doctrine, when rejected, destroys many things that are possible but cannot be proven, and when accepted, it drags along with it many things impossible and non-existent. As for the one point I have heard the Epicureans make against those spirits introduced by Empedocles, that it is not possible for beings who are base and prone to error to be blessed and long-lived, since wickedness is bound up with great blindness and liability to destruction. This is a foolish argument. For by this reasoning, Epicurus himself would prove inferior to Gorgias the sophist, and Metrodorus to Alexis the comic poet, since the latter lived twice as long as Metrodorus, and Gorgias more than a third longer than Epicurus. But we use the words strong and weak of virtue and vice in another sense, not with reference to the persistence or dissolution of the body. Since among animals too, many that are sluggish and dull of soul, and many that are unruly and undisciplined, live longer than the intelligent and clever ones. Hence, it is not right to base the eternity of God on his mere immunity and defense against destructive forces. Rather, freedom from passion and indestructibility ought to belong to the very nature of the blessed being, requiring no effort to maintain it. But perhaps it seems ungracious to argue against those not present. Let Cleombrotus, then, take up again the account he was giving us a moment ago about the departure and flight of the spirits, and finish it, "That is only just." And Cleombrotus said, "I should be surprised if it does not appear far stranger than what has already been said." And yet it does seem to touch on natural philosophy, and Plato gave the starting point for it, not stating it outright but casting, through an obscure opinion, an enigmatic and cautiously guarded suggestion. Nevertheless, a great outcry against him, too, has arisen from other philosophers. But since a bowl of myths and reasoned accounts mingled together stands set before us in our midst, and where might one find more sympathetic hearers before whom to test these tales, as one tests foreign coin? I do not hesitate to indulge you with the narrative of a barbarian man, whom, after much wandering and after paying great fees for the information, I finally managed to track down. A man who, near the Red Sea, met with human beings once each year, but for the rest of his time consorted, as he claimed, with wandering nymphs and spirits. I had the good fortune to obtain conversation and friendship with him. He was the handsomest of all men I have ever seen, and remained free of every illness throughout, eating only once each month a certain bitter medicinal fruit of an herb. He had trained himself to speak many languages, but with me he spoke mostly in Doric, not far removed in its rhythms from song. Whenever he spoke, a fragrance filled the place, his mouth breathing out the sweetest scent. His learning and knowledge in general were with him at all times, but for prophecy, he was inspired only on one day of each year, and would deliver his oracles as he went down to the sea. And rulers and royal secretaries would also come to visit him, and then depart. He then traced the art of prophecy back to spirits, and he had a great deal to say about Delphi, and was not unacquainted with anything said or performed there in the sacred rites concerning Dionysus, but declared that these two were great sufferings of spirits, including the events concerning Python. As for the one who killed the serpent, his exile, he said, lasted neither 9 years nor did it take him to Tempe, but rather, cast out, he went to another world. And later, after 9 cycles of great years had passed, having become pure and having truly returned as Phoebus, he took over the oracle, which until then had been guarded by Themis. And so it was, he said, with the battles of the Titans and of Typhon as well. There had been wars of spirits against spirits, and then the flight of the defeated, or punishments inflicted by a god upon those who had done wrong, such as Typhon is said to have done wrong against Osiris and Cronus against Uranus, whose honors have grown dim or have vanished altogether, now that they have removed to another world. For I hear that the Salami too, neighbors of the Lycians, honor Cronus above all others, but that after he killed their rulers, Arsalus and Dryas and Trisobius, he fled and moved off to some place or other, for they are unable to say where, and that he himself thereafter fell into neglect, while those around Arsalus came to be called harsh gods, and the Lycians, both publicly and privately, direct their curses against them. Many similar examples can be drawn from what is told about the gods. And if, said the stranger, we call certain spirits by the customary names of the gods, that need not surprise us. For each spirit likes to be called after the particular god to whom it is assigned, and from whom it has received its power and honor. Even among us, one man is called of Zeus, another Athenian, another Apollonian or Dionysian or Hermian, And while some of us are named rightly, by chance, most acquire epithets from the gods that do not properly belong to them, having been misapplied. When Cleombrotus fell silent, this account seemed marvelous to all present. But when Heraclian asked in what way this had anything to do with Plato, and how Plato had furnished the starting point for this account, Cleombrotus said, "You remember rightly that Plato from the outset rejected an infinite number of worlds, but was in doubt about a fixed plurality, and while conceding the plausibility, up to the number 5, of those who posit a single world corresponding to each of the elements, he himself held firmly to the position of a single world. And this seems to be peculiar to Plato, since the others were greatly afraid of plurality, on the ground that those who do not confine matter within a single unity, but at one step outside it, fall prey to a boundless and intractable infinity." "But did the stranger," I asked, "define the number of worlds, or, when you were in his company, did you not press him on this?" "I could hardly fail," said Cleombrotus, "if nothing else, to be an eager and attentive listener on these matters, since he offered himself so graciously and so willingly. He said there were neither infinite worlds, nor 1 nor 5, but 183, arranged in the shape of a triangle, each side of the triangle having 60 worlds. Of the 3 that remained, each was stationed at one of the corners, and the worlds next to one another touch, moving gently round as if in a dance. The plane within the triangle is the common hearth of them all, and is called the plane of truth, in which the accounts and forms and patterns of all things that have come to be and all that will come to be lie unmoved. And around these, time, as it were an outflow of eternity, is carried along toward the worlds. A sight and vision of these things is granted to human souls only once in 10,000 years, provided they have lived well. And the best of the initiations performed here are but a dream of that vision and that initiation there. And philosophical discourses have as their purpose to recall those beautiful things yonder, or else they are carried on in vain. These things, he said, I heard him relating as myth, exactly as in an initiation and a mystery rite, without bringing forward any proof or evidence for what he said. And I, turning to Demetrius, said, How does that verse about the suitors go, the one about their marveling at Odysseus as he handled the bow? And when Demetrius had recalled it for me, I said, This too occurs to me to say about the stranger. Surely he was some connoisseur and thief of doctrines and discourses of every kind, and much traveled in written learning, and no barbarian but a Greek by birth, brimful of much Greek culture. What refutes him is the very number of the worlds, which is not Egyptian nor Indian but Dorian, from Sicily, belonging to a man of Himera named Petron. I have not myself read any little book of his, nor do I know that one survives, but Hippias of Regium, whom Phanias of Eresus mentions, records that this was Petron's own opinion and account, that there are 183 worlds, touching one another according to element. But what exactly this touching, according to element, means, he does not further clarify, nor does he attach any other plausible explanation. Taking this up, Demetrius said, What plausibility could there be in such matters, when even Plato, though he said nothing that was reasonable or likely, nevertheless cast down the... And Heraclian said, But surely we hear from you grammarians, who trace back to Homer the opinion that he distributed the universe into 5 worlds, heaven, water, air, earth, and Olympus. Of these he leaves 2 in common. Earth belongs to the whole realm below, Olympus to the whole realm above, and the 3 in between are assigned to the 3 gods. In the same way Plato too, it seems, distributing the finest and primary forms and shapes of bodies among the differences of the whole, calls them 5 worlds. That of earth, that of water, that of air, that of fire, and last, the one that encompasses these, that of the dodecahedron, the most fluid and versatile figure, which he assigned as the shape most fitting and suited to the soul's revolutions and motions. And Demetrius said, Why do we bring in Homer at present? We have had enough of myths. Plato is far from calling the 5 differentiations of the world 5 worlds. Indeed, where he argues against those who posit infinite worlds, he says that in his own view this world is one, only begotten, and beloved of God, having come to be whole, complete, and self-sufficient out of the entirety of corporeal being. Hence one might well wonder that, having stated the truth himself, he furnished others with the starting point for an implausible and unreasoned opinion. For not keeping to a single world had at least some basis in the infinity of the universe as a whole. but to fix the number definitely at just so many, neither more nor fewer than five, is utterly irrational and detached from all plausibility. Unless you have something to say, he said, looking at me. And I said, it does seem so, that having already let go the discussion about oracles is finished, we should take up another topic just as large. Not letting go of that one, said Demetrius, but not passing by this one either, since it lays claim to our attention. We will not linger over it, but only touch on it enough to examine its plausibility, and then return to our original subject. Well then, first, I said, the things that prevent one from positing infinite worlds do not prevent one from making more than one. For it is quite possible for there to be both divination and providence in a plurality of worlds, and for only the smallest role to fall to chance, while the largest and most numerous events take on order with respect to coming into being and change, none of which infinity is by nature able to admit. Moreover, it follows more readily from reason that God should not be only begotten, nor be without company, and that the world should not be solitary. For being perfectly good, he lacks no virtue, least of all those concerned with justice and friendship, for these are the finest and most fitting for gods. And it is not the nature of God to possess anything in vain or useless. There are, then, outside it other gods and worlds, toward whom he exercises the social virtues, for there is no exercise of justice or grace or kindness toward oneself or one's own part, but only toward others. So it is not likely that this world drifts about an infinite void without a friend, without a neighbor, without any mingling with others, since we observe that nature, too, encloses each individual generation within kinds, as though within vessels or seed pods. For nothing among existing things belongs to a number of which there exists no common account, nor does anything attain such a designation unless it is qualified, either generically or specifically. Now the world is not said to be qualified generically. It is, then, qualified specifically, having become such through its difference from other things akin and of the same kind. For if nature has produced neither one man, nor one horse, nor one star, nor one god, nor one daimon, what prevents nature from having not one world either, but rather more than one? For the one who says that the world has one earth and one sea overlooks something obvious about things composed of like parts. We divide earth into parts bearing the same name, and sea likewise. But a part of the world is no longer a world, since it is composed of different natures. Moreover, that which some fear most, and for the sake of which they use up all matter on this one world, leaving nothing outside to disturb this world's composition with collisions or blows, they feared wrongly. For if there are several worlds, and each has been separately allotted a substance, and matter having a fixed measure and limit, nothing disorderly or unarranged will be left over, like some residue falling upon it from outside. For the rational principle governing each world, holding sway over the matter apportioned to it, will allow nothing to stray or wander out and fall in from another world, nor into itself from another, since its multitude has a nature neither undefined nor infinite, nor its motion irrational and disorderly. But if some effluence does travel from some worlds to others, it is akin and gentle, mingling mildly with all, like the rays and blendings of the stars. And the worlds themselves take delight in beholding one another benevolently, granting to the many good gods present in each one occasions for intermingling and friendly association. None of this is impossible, mythical, or irrational. Unless, by Zeus, someone suspects that Aristotle's arguments carry physical force here. For since each of the bodies has its own proper place, as he says, earth must necessarily move from every direction toward the center, and water settle upon it because of its weight, settling beneath the lighter elements. If then, there are several worlds, it will follow that earth will in many places lie above fire and air, and in many places below them. And air and water likewise will in some places be in their natural regions, in others in regions contrary to nature. Since these things are impossible, as he supposes, there cannot be either two worlds or more, but only this one, composed of the whole of substance, situated in accordance with nature, as befits the differences among the bodies. But this too has been stated plausibly rather than truly. Consider it this way, I said, my dear Demetrius. When he says that some bodies move toward the center and downward, others away from the center and upward, and others around the center and in a circle, with reference to what does he take the center? Surely not with reference to the void, for on his view there is no void. And for those who do admit it, the void has no center, just as it has no first point or last point, for these are limits, while the void is infinite and unlimited. And even if one forced oneself, by sheer violence of argument, to conceive of some center of an infinite void, what would be the difference in the motions of bodies produced with respect to it? For neither is there any power belonging to bodies in the void, nor do bodies have choice and impulse, longing for the center and straining toward it from every direction. Rather, it is equally impossible to conceive, with respect to soulless bodies and an incorporeal, undifferentiated region, either a motion originating from the bodies themselves or an attraction exerted by that region upon them. It remains, then, that the center is spoken of not spatially, but corporeally. For since this world of ours possesses a single unity and arrangement composed of several dissimilar bodies, the differences among them necessarily produce differing motions for different things relative to one another. And this is clear from the fact that, as each substance is transformed, it changes its region along with it. For separations lift matter up away from the center and distribute it in a circle, while combinations and condensations press it down toward the center and drive it together. On these matters, it is not necessary here to use many more words. For whatever cause one supposes to be the creative agent of these affections and changes, this same cause will hold each of the several worlds together within itself. For each world has its own earth and sea. For each also has its own center of its own, and its own affections of bodies, changes, nature, and power, which preserves and keeps each thing in its proper region. For that which lies outside, whether it is nothing or an infinite void, provides no center, as has been said. But since there are several worlds, each has its own particular center, so that the motion is particular too. For some bodies toward it, for others away from it, and for others around it, just as the peripatetics themselves distinguish. But whoever insists that, though there are many centers, heavy bodies must be pushed from everywhere toward one alone, differs in no way from someone who, since there are many people, insists that blood must flow together from everywhere into a single vein, and that everyone's brains must be contained within a single membrane, thinking it monstrous if, among natural bodies, all solid matter does not occupy one region and all rarefied matter another single region. For such a person would be as absurd, being indignant that wholes make use of their own parts, each part having its natural position and order within it. That would indeed be absurd. If someone said that a world was one that had the moon in it, the way a man might carry his brain in his heels and his heart in his temples. But making several worlds separate from one another, and together with the wholes bounding off and distributing their parts as well, is not absurd. For in each world the earth, sea, and heaven will be positioned according to nature as is fitting, and each of the worlds has its above, below, around, and center, not with reference to another world nor outside itself, but within itself and with reference to itself. For as to the stone that some suppose to lie outside the world, it does not readily admit of a conception either of remaining at rest or of moving. For how could it, having weight, either remain still or move toward our world like the rest of heavy bodies, being neither a part of it nor incorporated into its substance? But as for earth contained and bound together within another world, there is no need to raise the puzzle of why it does not, breaking off through its weight, migrate over into this one, once we observe the nature of the whole and the tension by which each of its parts is held together. For if we take below and above, not with reference to the world but outside it, we shall fall into the same difficulties as Epicurus, who moves all the atoms toward the regions beneath the feet, as though the void had feet, or as though infinity allowed one to conceive within itself of below and above. For this reason, one may well wonder at Chrysippus, or rather be utterly at a loss, as to what possessed him to say that the world is established in the middle, and that its substance, having eternally occupied the central place, is held together thereby not least for the sake of its permanence, and, so to speak, its indestructibility. For he says these things in the fourth book of his work on Possibles, though he is not correctly dreaming up a center for the infinite. and is positing as the cause of the world's permanence something more absurd than the permanence itself, a non-existent center. And this, though he has often said elsewhere that substance is governed and held together by motions toward its own center and motions away from its own center. And indeed, as for the rest of the Stoics' objections, who would be afraid of them, of those who ask how a single fate and providence could hold, and why there will not be many Disses and Zeuses if there are several worlds? For in the first place, if it is absurd for there to be many Disses and Zeuses, then surely their own view will be far more absurd. For in their infinite cycles of worlds, they make an infinite number of suns and moons, Apollos and Artemises and Poseidons. And in the second place, what necessity is there for there to be many Zeuses if there are several worlds, and not, in each one, a first ruling and governing God possessing mind and reason, such as he who among us is called Lord of all and Father? Or what will prevent all the worlds from being subject to the fate and providence of a single Zeus, who oversees and directs each in turn, implanting in all of them the beginnings, seeds, and principles of the things that come to pass? For it is not the case here that a single body is often composed of separate bodies, as an assembly, an army, or a chorus, each of which, as Chrysippus supposes, happens to live, think, and learn as a unit. While in the universe as a whole it is impossible for 10, 50, or 100 worlds to make use of a single reason and to be arranged under a single governing principle. On the contrary, such an arrangement is altogether fitting for gods. For one ought not to make the gods rulers confined without exit, like the leaders of a swarm guarding by shutting themselves in, or rather sealing themselves up within matter, as these thinkers do, who make the gods into mere states of air and blended powers of water and fire, holding that they are born together with the world and again burned up together with it, not free and independent, like charioteers or helmsmen, but just as statues are riveted and fused to their pedestals. So shut up within the corporeal and bolted fast to it, sharing in its fate all the way to its destruction, its total dissolution, and its change. That other account, I think, is more dignified and more magnificent, that the gods, being without master and self-ruling, come to the aid of those caught in storms just as the sons of Tyndarus do, approaching and by their power calming the sea and the swift blasts of the winds, not themselves sailing along and sharing the danger, but appearing from above and bringing deliverance. In just this way they visit now one, now another of the worlds, drawn by the pleasure of the spectacle and guiding each in accordance with its nature. For Homer's Zeus shifted his gaze no great distance, from Troy to Thrace and the nomads around the Ister. But the true Zeus enjoys fine and fitting changes of scene among a plurality of worlds, gazing not out upon an empty infinity, nor upon nothing at all else, as some have supposed, but contemplating the many works of gods and men, and the movements and courses of the stars in their revolutions. For the divine does not shun change, but delights in it greatly, if we are to judge from visible things by the successive changes and revolutions in the heavens. Infinity, then, is altogether senseless and irrational, admitting God nowhere at all, but treating everything according to chance and automatically. Whereas care and providence exercised over a definite multitude and number of worlds seems to me to have nothing more undignified or more burdensome about it than care and providence sunk into a single body, attached to that one thing, endlessly reshaping and remolding it. Having said this much, then, I stopped. Philip, after not pausing long, said, "As to whether the truth about these matters stands this way or otherwise, I myself would not insist. But if we remove God from a single world, I think I should be glad to learn why we make him the craftsman of five worlds only and not more, and what the relation of this number to the totality is, gladder, indeed, than to learn the meaning of the dedication of the E here. For neither is a triangle. Is neither triangular nor square, nor perfect, nor cubic, nor does it appear to offer any other elegance to those who delight in and admire such things. As for the approach from the elements, which he himself hinted at, it is altogether hard to grasp, and shows nothing of the plausibility that drew him on to say that, given five bodies with equal angles and equal sides contained by equal planes, once they have come to be present in matter, that many worlds are immediately produced from them." And indeed, I said, Theodorus of Soli seems to me to pursue the argument not badly in expounding Plato's mathematics. He proceeds as follows. The pyramid, the octahedron, the icosahedron, and the dodecahedron, which Plato ranks first, are all beautiful in the proportions and equalities of their ratios, and it is impossible to compose anything better than they are, or anything similar, for nature to fit together. Yet they do not all belong to a single class of construction, nor do they have a similar origin. Rather, the pyramid is the finest and smallest, while the dodecahedron is the largest and made of the most parts. Of the remaining two, the icosahedron is greater than the octahedron, or more than double it, in the number of its triangles. Hence it is impossible for all of them to come into being from matter at the same time. For the fine and small bodies, being simpler in construction, must be the first to submit to and be shaped by that which moves and fashions matter, and must be completed and pre-exist before the coarser bodies made of many parts, whose composition is more laborious, bodies such as the dodecahedron is composed of. It follows from this that the pyramid alone is the first body to exist, while none of the others exist yet, since nature is still short of producing them. There is, then, a remedy also for this absurdity, the division and separation of matter into five worlds. In one place the pyramid arose, for it came to be first, in another the octahedron, in another the icosahedron. And from the body that pre-existed in each, the rest will have their origin, since change occurs in all things for all things through the combination and separation of parts, as Plato himself indicates, going through the matter in nearly full detail, though for us a brief account will suffice. Since air arises when fire is extinguished, and becoming rarefied again, in turn gives off fire from itself, one must observe the affections and changes in the seeds of each. Now the seeds of fire are the pyramid, composed of 24 primary triangles. The octahedron, that of air, is composed of 48 of the same triangles. So one element of air comes to be from two elements of fire combined and united together. And conversely, the element of air, when broken up, separates into two bodies of fire. But when it is compressed upon itself again and collapses, it passes into the form of water. Thus everywhere the body that pre-exists always readily provides, through change, the origin of all the others. And it is not the case that there is only one first body, while another body, having in a different system the initiating and anticipatory motion toward generation, keeps the same name in all cases. And Ammonius said, "These points have been worked out by Theodorus manfully and with great ambition, but I would be surprised if he does not seem to be using premises that destroy one another."